Thank you very much. Thank you for asking me. It's wonderful to be here. When coming into this room again, brought up all this range of very, very deep feelings. When I came to Zen practice, it was actually the most important thing that had occurred in my life, and it essentially started in this room. So I wanted to thank and acknowledge Santa Cruz Zen Center and Catherine Thanis, my teacher, and thank you so much for having me. One of the first things that I noticed when I came in the room here was a sense, a feeling that is a little bit hard to describe, but when you come into a zendo, there's a certain sensibility, the architecture, the way that the room is laid out, the care and the consideration all communicate something about Soto Zen. And it's a very distinct, warm feeling that comes up for me. And this is really what I wanted to talk about, is the feeling of Zen practice. And I should back up. And the word feeling is a wonderfully nebulous sort of word, but it actually correctly conveys a certain sensibility that I think that I find here in Zen practice. And what I mean by that is that in Mahayana Buddhism, there's certain ontological teachings. There are teachings that help us uncover reality, that show us reality, that actually reveal the nature of reality. So, for example, most of you know the teaching of emptiness, or shunyata, or empty of own inherent self-existence, that all phenomena lack inherent enduring self-existence. At the same time, they have all reality has a composite or dependent nature. This is a very fundamental teaching in Zen and Mahayana. But at the same time, there's a certain feeling in Zen practice that communicates and conveys this teaching, that I find it's very distinct, and it's very revealing, and it's very particular to Soto Zen. It's not as though other types of Buddhism don't reveal the teaching, but in Soto Zen there's a certain distinct style, a certain house style, a certain family style that is very dear and near to my own heart. So you could say that the feeling that of emptiness is conveyed in Soto Zen by the sense of not being stuck, or the idea from Suzuki Roshi of not necessarily so, or the phrase don't know, that they all convey the sensibility of not getting stuck, of not latching on and hooking on to a particular people, places, and things, and staying with them. It's wonderful in the sense that what Zen practice does is it's constantly pulling the rug out from under each time we try to light onto something and make it into a particular thing, make it into something complete. So my teachers, when I was actually came to Zen practice, because I was really interested in how they moved in the world, how they revealed the teaching in the way that they moved, in the way they conveyed their comportment, their movement, their demeanor. it was very important to me. I was very much intrigued how Zen communicates through the body, that most of our teaching and practice is actually instruction on the posture, in forms, in movement. And this was all very, very interesting to me because I came from a philosophical background. I was interested in philosophy, but there's not so much that you can do with philosophy except for study other philosophy. Zen practice, there was something I could do. There was a physical activity that conveyed and communicated the deepest teaching. And this was profoundly moving to me to see this and understand this. So when I first saw Catherine Thanos, the main thing that I paid attention to was how she moved. And I was very much intrigued in her movement and what it conveyed, what it communicated, and what it revealed about Mahayana teaching. In the same way that, you know, we do certain rituals here and here. We perform in a, you know, we could say that when we sat down tonight, we sat down in a ritual sort of form, in a sense. So the ritual of Zazen, or the ceremony of Zazen, as it sometimes is talked about, we sit in this posture, and in that sitting, just in that sitting, in the ritual of Zazen, there is a great deal that is communicated to us. There is a great deal that is revealed to us just by doing that. In the same way that we do certain, the ritual of Kinhin communicates a certain feeling sense of Soto Zen practice. And it's not as though that you can actually, you know, put your name on it, but it communicates a sensibility from the Mahayana. So there's a certain type of scripting that goes on in Zen practice, and it actually shapes how we perceive the world. It communicates in this shaping sort of quality. It informs certain patterns on us that hopefully stay and communicate with us. So I was always very interested in this family style, or understanding our practice through the physical forms, through the movement, through our function. There's a wonderful story about the rabbinical student who goes to see Rabbi Lowenstein, and he says, "I did not go to study scriptures with Rabbi Lowenstein. I went to learn how he tied his shoes." And that's something of my interest in working with Catherine Thanos. I was interested in how she moved and comported herself in the world. When Catherine, she had asked me to become a priest, and she said, "One of the conditions that I have for you being a priest is that I want you to wear this robe. I want you to wear the black robe." And she didn't say it at the time, but I suspected that I was always sort of an abrupt, not so graceful person, and I always felt that ultimately, the reason why she had me wear the robe was to actually slow me down. But at the same time, wearing the robe reveals a great deal about Zen forms, about Soto Zen forms in particular. No matter how, you know, much you move in a robe, you cannot move too fast. You have to move in a certain sort of way. So it's a little bit like slowing down and moving slowly through the dark. You have to feel your way carefully and considerately. And I always thought that this was in the back of her mind, that she would put me in this robe to teach me this, the teaching of Mumetsu no Kafu, the Soto term meaning careful and considerate way. So I was very much interested in how the robe communicates, how it teaches us, in the same way how we move in this room here that is quite distinct and quite different than how we would move in, say, the average bowling alley or someplace else. The forms hold us and teach us and allows us to reveal our own practice in a very distinct kind of way. There's a number of texts on this form. The wonderful case from the Shoyuroku or the Book of Serenity, case 20, in which there's two Zen teachers, they meet on the road, and one of them is carrying their bag, and one says, where are you going? And the other one says, I'm going on a pilgrimage. And then the other one asks again, well, what's the purpose of your pilgrimage? And the first one says, I don't know. Then the other one says back to him, not knowing is most intimate. And it reminded me this, you know, the pilgrimage, of course, is our life. You know, our life, our spiritual life in some sense. We are always on this pilgrimage, this road. And it reminded me when I first came to Zen practice, and if someone were to ask me why I came to Zen practice, I would, you know, I'd give them some sort of answer. But ultimately, I did not know. I didn't want to admit it. I thought I should know. I thought I should know why I was here on the black cushion. But I really didn't know. And I didn't realize later that it's really, most people don't know why they come and sit. They don't know that you'll, or that changes. So this idea of being on this pilgrimage, and this not knowing is so intimate and dear in the sense that in Bodhidharma, the first case of the Blue Cliff Record, Bodhidharma has a conversation with Emperor Wu, and at the end of it, Emperor Wu asks Bodhidharma, well, who are you? Bodhidharma says, don't know. And it's that same sensibility, that same sense. Now, Bodhidharma was, the first ancestor in China. And he knew who he was. He could have given out his resume. He could have told Emperor Wu, well, I'm a Sagittarius and I like the color blue or I like this. He could have recited his education. But he did not do that. He came from an entirely different perspective. He came from the bottom of his experience. He came from the absolute. And in a sense, we cannot really say, you know, why we do things or how we do things, or we can come up with provisional answers that will get us by. But from the deepest sense of to ask the question, where are you going and what are you doing and who are you, requires actually a kind of not knowing or deep unknowing. You know, in the sense of that we can come up with, you know, provisional answers that'll get us through customs or etc. But it's not a real answer in one sense. It's our resume that we can put up there. But we have another answer behind that, and that's this not knowing, this don't know, which is wonderful to hold. And then the answer, you know, when he comes up, says, don't know, of course, it's this wonderfully, not only is a wonderfully humble, but it's a wonderfully honest answer, and it's a wonderfully rich answer. It's the deepest answer that he could apply in the situation. If you look at the idea of knowing. Knowing in this sense, if someone's going to ask you this type of question, where are you going or who are you, and you know in some sort of absolute final kind of way, I think we're in trouble in some sort of sense. That knowing in that way is a little bit like the wonderful metaphor of looking up at the sky through the tube of our knowing and our beliefs and all our ideas, and all that we can see of the sky is just that tiny little patch that is created by all of what we think we know. You know, when actually the world is much more vast, it is much larger, and it has much more to reveal to us. So this idea of not knowing is, you know, in a sense, a wonderful corrective to this habit of always knowing. It's a wonderful corrective to the idea that, you know, we have to come into a job or a relationship and, you know what we're talking about, right? We can't make mistakes and not know. That would be, you know, we're of a certain age and we need to come up with answers and know what's going on and know what's right. But this little dialogue allows us a break from that habit of always having to know in some sense, some sort of final authoritative way. And it gives us this great freedom that we already have, this great flexibility and movement. So when I don't know, when I'm humble, when I'm ready to be fearless, when I'm ready to be open, my life opens in a certain kind of way. This wonderful teacher, Joan Sutherland, says that it allows us to become fetchable. Instead of us fetching this, that, and the other, it allows us to open in ways that we never imagined, that just by not knowing. When I know, when I bring myself forward, imposing myself on experience, on this moment, I've run into a kind of roadblock. I've narrowed my gap. I've narrowed my options. But when I don't know, when I let experience come forward and reveal itself and reveal me, things open up. Things seem to open up. I once asked Catherine Thanis. I said to her, "Well, what should be the best attitude, or what's the best policy? What should be the idea I have, the feeling I have when I approach the altar during service? You know, should it be one of humility, reverence, something like that, respect?" And she said the best policy is to have no policy at all. To have no idea of you as priest or you as altar, to have no division in a sense, to not know how to approach the altar was the best policy. To have no idea, to be actually open to the altar and to you, and to be in the midst of sort of a richness, she said. There's another short saying about this idea of not knowing from Sekido Kisan. And someone asked Sekido Kisan, "What is the meaning of Buddha Dharma?" And he replies, "No gaining, no knowing." And then he asked him again, "Well, can you say more?" And he says, "The expansive sky does not obstruct the white floating clouds. Just lets them come and go. Lets them come and go without knowing. It's not as though we're going to forget who we are, forget how to drive cars, or forget how to function society, or not know our name or our friend's name. That is always with us. But it allows us the option to, at the same time, to be alive to the world in certain ways that knowing prohibits us. That knowing won't allow us, that knowing confines us and controls us. Dogen writes about the feeling of not knowing. He says, "Water is neither strong nor weak, neither wet nor dry, neither moving nor still, neither hot nor cold, neither existent nor non-existent, neither deluded nor enlightened. Water solidifies. It is harder than a diamond. Who can crack it? When it melts, it is gentler than rain." He goes on to say in another text, "When we sail a boat in the ocean beyond the sight of land, and our eyes scan the horizon in the four directions, it simply looks like a circle. No other shape appears. This great ocean, however, is neither round nor square. It has inexhaustible characteristics. To a fish, it looks like a palace. To heavenly beings, a jeweled necklace. To us, as far as the eye can see, it looks like a circle. All myriad things are like this." So, if I only see ocean as circle, my eye, my vision is entirely limited. If my perspective is just from my perspective of circle. At the same time, fish see ocean in an entirely different lived way. Astronauts would see ocean as a jewel in the sky, but actually, ocean is none of these. It's not round. It's not a palace. It's not a jewel. It's not glittering. And at the same time, it is all of these things as well. So it is wet, blue, vast, nourishing, and so on. So its qualities are infinite. So we can't just confine it and define it simply as ocean, which severely limits it. Yeah. In the same way, if you say, well, here comes that person and they're reckless, or they're beautiful, or we ascribe some other quality or characteristic to them, we've limited them, already, just by that imputation of saying, well, there comes old so-and-so. And we've totally limited that person to whatever imputation we have. I was at a, I worked for a nonprofit organization, and I had to go to a meeting, and part of the meeting was billed as a networking meeting, where networking is all well, fine, and good, and valuable. And I went in there, and I had my networking sign on, and I had a badge, and I was looking for other networkers. And I went up, and I talked to this woman, and this was a perfectly wonderful woman with a very full, rich life. And I noticed that partway through our conversation, my mind was thinking, well, I should move on to the next person because we're networking, right? And I need to move on. In the meantime, here was this perfectly charming, rich person, and I could not see past the networking sign. And it's the same way, that we do this. I do this all the time. We don't see the rich fullness of everyone's life, the background of one's life, James Joyce's Ulysses is 900 pages, and it's devoted to the life of one man in one day. 900 pages. And everyone's life is like that, in a sense. Everyone's life has that rich, huge dimension that we miss any time we ascribe or impute or impose friend or enemy, network, good person, bad person. Anytime we ascribe whatever imputation we put on them, we neglect or diminish them. So the emptiness of things creates an unlimited world for us, creates nothing but potentiality in each encounter. It's not just, you know, just in the Zendo, but each and every encounter is meeting Bloom and Ulysses, 900 pages of richness that we're able to meet and to tap into. So when I apply in a certain kind of sign to this person, I've actually, you know, severely limited. Anytime if I come into a conversation with you and I come in with an attitude or an assumption that, well, I know who you are and I know what you're going to say, I've totally sabotaged the conversation from the beginning. I've limited it entirely right from the beginning. But if I come into it with an attitude of, I don't know what I'm going to say, I don't know what they're going to say, I don't know what the encounter is going to bring, it could be hugely rich, it could be hugely large and expansive if I don't know, if I simply don't know what is in front of me. If I ask the question, what is this? If I simply ask, what is it that thus comes right in front of me? There's a artist, probably some of you know, Jasper Johns, and he, when he was a young man, he could draw anything. He could draw in meticulous detail any kind of thing with, you know, an exact sort of rendering. He was a very good draftsman, but as he got older, he began to draw flags and maps, and he still knew how to render, but in one sense he let go of his ideas about what flags and maps look like. He applied what Suzuki Roshi called his shoshin, or beginner's mind. He, you know, if he would have come into his drawing or painting with any kind of fixed idea what a flag or map looked like, then he would have rendered the same sort of detailed maps or flags. But his flags and maps were blooming, were hugely expansive, simply by dropping, you know, what he knew about flags and maps in a certain sense. He still had the technical skill, it was still there, but he let go of that and applied this idea of shoshin, or beginner's mind. You know, in this sense, the flag is limited, has unlimited potential. The idea of patriotism has unlimited potential in this sense. If we don't know what patriotism quite is, if we don't know what it is, it can be a rich and blooming thing. It doesn't have to be narrow. It doesn't have to be confined. It doesn't have to be anything at all. It has this great potentiality that is alive and blooming. Sometimes the neurologists call this idea divergent thinking, the idea that creativity involves not only coming up with something new, but also shutting down the brain's habitual responses or of letting go of conventional solutions. So Lewis Hyde says that the agile mind is pleased to find what it is not looking for. It is pleased to find what it is not looking for. It can wander about without any fixed idea about Zen or Zen practice or Buddhism or Zen and be wonderfully lively. So this idea of not knowing is, you could call it, well, you could call it this, the condition of mind that is without maps, without assumptions, without prejudice, without our cherished beliefs, without the stories that we always have to tell about each and everything. We can let the world open just as it is, and it blooms. I'm making an assumption here, but I'm assuming that this is Santa Cruz water. It might not be. But in actuality, it may or may not be what so-called Santa Cruz water, but when I taste it, it has nothing to do with the concept Santa Cruz water. It has nothing to do with that. It is wet, it is clear, it is clean, it is something entirely different than concept Santa Cruz water. It is an entirely rich, voluminous experience that has little to do with Santa Cruz water. So I may think it's Santa Cruz water, and I might carry that around, but it does not add to the experience of this water. In fact, it limits it in some sort of sense. There was one of my favorite stories is that in Japan, in Kyoto, Japan, once a week, these two senior students would have tea and rice cakes with their teacher. And one afternoon, they go in and have tea and rice cakes with the teacher, and it's a sweltering hot Kyoto afternoon. It's very hot. And there's a fan on the table there, and the teacher says, "What's that?" And the first student picks up the fan, and he fans the teacher's face. It's a pretty good answer, right? I mean, it's direct, it's clear, it's non-conceptual. It gets right to the point. Then the other student picks up the fan, puts a rice cake on it, and serves it to the teacher. And he goes, "Oh, this is a very good answer." So to limit the... So fan has no fixed nature. It has no fixed nature. It has a provisional nature as fan, but all things are like this in the sense that you know, it is free to be a serving tray. It is free to be a tablet to write on. It has limited possibilities. It does not have to be just fan. It does not have to just be that. It has this great potentiality. So the sensibility in this story is what I'm calling the feeling of Soto Zen practice, of not constantly harboring this fixing on things and saying exactly what they are, not holding to fixed views. My favorite Catherine Thanos story is that I guess it was 1967 or 1968. There's a fall practice period at Tassajara, And it was a Shosan ceremony. And Suzuki Roshi was there, and people were invited to come up and ask him questions. And Catherine goes up and in front of the large group and says, "Dako Roshi," I'm paraphrasing this, but it says, "Dako Roshi, who are you?" And he turns and says something like, "Me? Do you really see all of me?" And she says something like, "Well, I feel there is much there." And then there's laughter in the background. And then there's a silence. And then he says something like, "Well, I am a person of size, shape, and form, but I am also someone of no size, shape, and form. I am a person of limited means, but I am also unlimited." And I thought that this was, you know, this was very similar to the first answer of not knowing, but it was actually more incomplete in the sense that it included the absolute side, but it also included the relative side. And I thought it was a wonderful way of including that I am a person of color, say, shape, size, and form. And then I am also have this huge background that we don't see, we don't recognize. We have to put on, or I have to put on a robe to slow down, to see that there is no other, in a sense. I have to, there's things that we have to do. There's instructions that we have to take to be able to see this background in our life. It's a little bit like gravity. We don't pay attention to gravity unless, you know, we do something, unless something happens in the same way. So maybe there's some comments or questions. Yes.
So I start with I don't know, but I also have a lot of evidence that if someone says to me, "I don't think global warming is happening and so we shouldn't do anything about it," for one thing, I don't think I could, again, the other practice is that so? I don't think I don't know, or is that so is the appropriate answer to that person's remark. And I don't think I don't know, or is that so, is appropriate response to what is apparently a process that is happening in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, in that instance, how do you then marry those two, the absolute and the provisional? Because some response does seem to be wanting to be evoked, and let's say in terms of global warming,
mm-hmm.
or any other number of.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I agree with you. I agree with you in the sense that we do need to do something. We do, given the information, given what we know, given the tools that we have, given what other people know, then what we can do is take certain steps. We can act on the best sort of information. It doesn't mean we don't do something. We still can do something given the information. But this idea of not knowing is, you know, it creates a it creates more sort of solutions, more possible solutions to global warming than, well, I know what to do about global warming. I know what to do about that. I know we should. I know exactly what to do. That sort of limits the application of many sorts of prospects that we can, steps that we can take. Whereas if, and, you know, there's certain things that, in this case, that we, you know, that we can do, we can apply, we know certain things, and to act on that information. If that information changes, if that changes, which it surely will, if that system changes, then to take another action, to act accordingly on that. But in a sense, to be flexible given the information, given what we know, and to have an open heart and an open mind in any sort of situation, and not narrowing it.
Do you think there's a cue from the space of I don't know when something harmful, quote unquote, seems to be going on in the world? We're sitting in a place of I don't know, and is that so? What gives us a sense of it's time to move, it's time to act, something's happening, something is wrong?
Well,
what do we hear? What tips us off?
Well, I think again, there's using your own innate intelligence, using the intelligence of others, using the whatever sort of response to the situation that might be appropriate at the time would be my action, would be, you know, given the myriad sort of things that we can do, might not just be limited to one response. It might be many. In fact, it might require many sort of actions, particularly when you're talking something so interdependent as global warming. I think that there was a text, Fridtjof Capra wrote a text about this, and he talked about it in terms of systems theory, that something like global warming has to be addressed on many, many different fronts by many different people. So there's not sort of, and that is, you know, this an application of not knowing, in a sense of not thinking that there's one particular way to solve this. Yes.
Well, sometimes Catherine really blew it. What did you learn from that?
When Catherine blew it? Well, that was actually the probably the richest time in terms of, because it would reveal her humanity, and by revealing her humanity, it revealed my humanity. And in a sense, it made it very much okay to blow it, to mess up, to not know. So Catherine, you know, Catherine was was very much a human, in a human body, in a human life, and of course, susceptible to all the mistakes and errors that we do. And what, you know, the thing I can say that in my conversations with her is that she was very upfront about her mistakes, about putting her mistakes out for all to see, in a sense. So it encouraged me to do make the same sort of efforts. So that's how I respond in terms of you know, errors or foibles or what she did or didn't do right or didn't do wrong. That she lived this human life. Same with Suzuki Roshi. He was not, perhaps not the best father at times. We don't know. And so, you know, we live this human life and we make this best effort that we can. And you know, this idea of putting our pain and our mistakes right out in the middle of the room, right in the middle of the room for everybody to see. And it changes the mistake. I mean, it changes, it takes the 300-pound elephant and it changes it into something else. So what I liked about Catherine is that I would often have conversations with her about my mistakes, and she would join with her mistakes and put them out in the middle of the room, and then we would you know, essentially have a different relationship to what it was, you know, that so without shame or fear or the pain around them, to see it in a different kind of way. So she made many mistakes, but she often, at least in my conversations with her, she was able to put them out in the room and say, well, here is this, and this came up because of these conditions, and I'm having reluctance to work with it because of this condition, etc., etc., etc. So it opened up mistakes to be made, in a sense. It's how I'm thinking of it now.
And now I'm embarrassed to admit that, because obviously that's something I know I really have to always work on.
Mm-hmm.
But when she said that, you know, I didn't even know what she meant.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go away and actually think about it.
Mm-hmm.
What does she mean, slow down? and that's really that teaching of her mm-hmm. body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for whatever difficulties sometimes she had in the interpersonal realm, you know, she was always very, very, very consistent with the physicality
mm-hmm.
and that kind of approach to training.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you reminding me, bringing it forth in the room for all of us to consider.
Mm. Thank you. So, it's 7:30.
Isn't there something, too, that's not so great about not knowing? I mean, it's good in that you don't want to be in a tube. On the other hand, it's evasive.
How?
Well, if you're talking with someone and they always say, I don't know, it feels as if they're not willing to put out what's going on inside.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah,
and that's evasive.
Well, I think that this not knowing that is being addressed in this text is not said in the sense I feel that is evasive, or it comes from his deepest experience. It's not as though that this is one little dialogue and probably many, many conversations. So I don't feel that I feel that if he were to ask them, you know, another question, he would probably have another answer other than I don't know. I don't think that's the only thing in his repertoire. I think that, but if we're talking about our life as Buddha Dharma, our life as Buddha nature. We can't say, well, I am a certain person and I have these problems and I have these afflictive emotions and I have these behaviors. And so I do know that that comes up. I do know that comes up. But then there's another part of my life where I cannot quite say what it is. So both of these parts are true in a sense. Both of these aspects are true. So I think maybe later on he would have answered in a different kind of way to a different question. But I think we're taking a part of a question that has a huge answer to it. But there's lots of responses to these, and it's not, and I don't feel that at a different time, I think he would have had a different response to a different, he would have said, well, I do like this, or I don't like that. It might have been the appropriate response, but for who are you and where are you going at this time in this place with these people, don't know is just right. It is most intimate, as he says. He says later, it is most intimate. It is the most intimate thing that we can share with someone in a sense. But that doesn't mean you wouldn't add commentary later to that. Doesn't mean that there wouldn't something else be said, something added about our human life. But he's talking about our human life and our absolute life in one. So it's a good, very good question. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Mm-hmm.